Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Dave Wasserman of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. We'll talk with him later about how the midterm elections are shaping up in some key ag district races. But first, here's this week's headlines. A new report shows global hunger is going in the wrong direction. The State of Food Security and Nutrition report shows 828 million people were affected by hunger in 2021. That figure is 46 million people higher than 2020 and 150 million higher than the figures observed before the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. About 2.3 billion people experienced a lesser form of food insecurity, a figure that's 350 million people higher than pre-pandemic levels. The report is a joint effort of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the UN World Food Program, and several other groups. They say if current trends persist, nearly 670 million people will be facing hunger in 2030, well above the zeroing out of hunger pushed for by the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Back in the U.S., farmer sentiment is stable but low. The Ag Economy Barometer fell slightly in June as producers signaled a concern for the future conditions the industry will face. 51% of the 400 producers surveyed say they expect their farms to be worse off financially a year from now. Just about 20 respondents who grow crops say they plan to change their planting decisions for the 2023 growing season based on rising input costs. Many of those producers are looking at upping their wheat acreage. And finally, the election picture is coming into focus across the country as primary season begins to wrap up. The majority of states have chosen their general election candidates, but several factors are weighing in on who voters will ultimately choose in November. One of those factors is the Supreme Court, which had an active June with several opinions that have been hotly debated in the public square since they were released. When we spoke to election analyst Dave Wasserman, we asked him what we know at this point about the court's impact on voter engagement.
Like, there's always a temptation to believe that what's in the news now is going to guide what decisions voters make in November. Back at the end of February, it looked like this midterm would be all about Ukraine. When the leaked Roe decision came out, it pivoted towards abortion, and that faded behind concerns about inflation. Now we're back on to Roe, but the question is it going to be a durable motivator for Democrats before Election Day? There is a sense of dread on the left that the Supreme Court is fundamentally reshaping the country in a conservative direction, but there's also an exhaustion that's set in the Democratic base after 4 years of fighting Donald Trump. And there has been a consistent enthusiasm advantage for Republicans who are motivated to throw out Democrats and eager to knock Joe Biden in this midterm election. That has ranged from 8 points when asked the question, what level would you rate your interest in the midterm elections as? Whether you'd rate it at least a 9 out of 10. Republicans have enjoyed an advantage of between 8 and 17 points on that question all year. And that will determine whether this is a Category 4 or 5 hurricane headed towards Democrats. One thing that we do know is that inflation and these high prices are not going away over the next 4 months. And that means that on balance, Republicans are the ones with a big advantage.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the inflation point there, I mean, we are currently seeing gas prices trend a little bit lower right now. They're still at historic highs, but they are lower than they were in recent weeks. We also see some level of inflation softening, not to the degree that many consumers would obviously like. Do you think there's any kind of electoral impact come November, or do you think the levels are still going to be high enough that it's going to serve as a motivating factor to still consider inflation to be high at that point?
Yeah, well, the message of inflation isn't quite as bad as it was a few months ago isn't a great political bumper sticker. And the fact is, voters of all stripes are feeling the pain, whether it's at the pump or in the grocery store right now. And Joe Biden has an approval rating that's hovering around 40%. That's not far off where Donald Trump was in 2018 when Republicans lost 40 House seats and control of the House. The difference, I'd say, between those 40% is that Donald Trump's 40 or 41% was highly motivated. They always stuck with him, and they were enthusiastic about him through thick or thin. And I think that prevented 2018 from becoming even worse for Republicans, allowed them to pick up two Senate seats in red states. Whereas on the Democratic side, you know, Democrats' base has been lethargic with sudden jolts from Supreme Court decisions on abortion, guns, and other topics. And I do think the abortion issue is most likely to help Democrats in state races where there are questions about the future of state laws in the post-Roe era. But at the congressional level, Democrats have a very tough map. Republicans appear to have already netted three seats from redistricting alone. And then obviously the Senate map is challenging for Democrats because they can't afford any erosion from Biden's standing in places like Georgia, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina, New Hampshire from 2020. In fact, Biden lost North Carolina and only won the other states by very, very thin margins. And there has been quite a bit of erosion in support for Biden since he was elected.
We'll be right back to discuss the upcoming midterm elections with Dave Wasserman right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. When Democrats retook the House majority in 2018, they did so with a long list of more moderate lawmakers from suburban and rural districts. Now, some of those same lawmakers are in trouble as election forecasters rate many of their races as toss-ups. When we spoke with Dave Wasserman of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter, we asked him about those races.
I do think there are probably 30 races that are on the bubble that are genuine toss-ups in the House right now. And Democrats do have a path to holding them, particularly if they're able to motivate core constituencies. Abigail Spanberger, for example, was pushed out of her Richmond base by redistricting. Now she has to run in the suburbs of D.C., and she drew an opponent from the Republican primary, Yesley Vega, who is fairly far to the right, is a MAGA activist, and Spanberger can portray Vega as being outside the mainstream on abortion and a whole host of other issues to try and just get by. Now, even though she doesn't represent most of the new constituents in that district, she did get a bluer district in redistricting. Biden would have won the seat by 7 points versus just one in her current district. So she still has a path. Angie Craig in Minnesota still has a path to reelection. These are kind of the blue state suburbs where the overturning of Roe could provide Democrats with a lifeline because voters don't want to or voters want to check against the Supreme Court moving the country too far right. But it's going to be tougher for Democrats in non-major metro areas, places where there's not as reliable a Democratic turnout base. And you know that could include districts in the Central Valley of California or South Texas. And there are just an awful lot of close races out there that are likely to decide whether Republicans gain 20 seats in the House or 30 seats.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the Senate side of Capitol Hill, obviously the Democrats hold the thinnest majority a party could possibly have right now. Republicans thinking they have a realistic chance to overtake that majority and claim the chamber for their own. If you're a Senate Republican, what needs to go right between now and November for your party to claim the majority, do you think?
Well, their candidates need to stay on message. That's the top priority for Senate Republicans. What we know from watching the last 15 years of Senate races is that Republicans are capable of getting in their own way. And occasionally they've nominated candidates who have said or done things that have torpedoed their own chances of getting elected. Now, that was most prominent in 2010 and 2012, when Republicans probably should have won the Senate but didn't. This time around, there are a couple of potential problem areas for Senate Republicans. Georgia, with Herschel Walker, who is a legendary Heisman Trophy winning running back, a great motivational speaker, but has pretty thin prescriptions when it comes to policy and has really stumbled and struggled to explain some of his business dealings and his family baggage. Or Blake Masters in Arizona, who's defending some of the writings he made in college at Stanford, where he talked about opposing U.S. involvement in World War II. Or Eric Greitens in Missouri, who is a disgraced former governor who's in the hunt for the Republican nomination there, and Democrats would be enticed to play in that red state if Greitens, who's badly underwater with all voters in terms of his image, is the Republican nominee. So between Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania and the others I mentioned, there is a potential for Democrats to kind of steal or to win a Senate race that they have no business winning in a year as Republican as this one.
Mm-hmm. And just wrapping up here, as we look back, we talked about the Senate there, talking back about the House now, there are some projections of the, post-November looking like a R+25 House of Representatives or thereabouts. Your thoughts on whether or not that, between now and then, the things that could change that could lead to, that R+25 potentially slimming, toward the Democrats or maybe even swelling toward the Republicans even more?
Yeah, I do think there's potential for a slimmed down Republican majority rather than a large one. Keep in mind that Republicans are starting out from a pretty high floor here after picking up a dozen House seats in 2020. So they're already at 214 seats. They only need to pick up four to retake the majority. That's a very low bar. But whether Republicans pick up 15 or 30 seats really will determine how much leeway Kevin McCarthy would have as Speaker. Now, I could see Democrats hanging on to a number of these swing suburban seats, Kansas's 3rd District, Minnesota 2, Virginia 2 or 7. Go on down the list, there are plenty of highly competitive places that could make the difference. And I see the same kind of potential late engagement on the Democratic side that we saw on the Republican side during the Kavanaugh fight in 2018. Arguably that fight helped Republicans hold a few House races in redder areas and also helped them gain Senate seats. This time around, Democrats are defending a lot of places that Biden won by between 5 and 10 points, or even between 10 and 15 points. We're even talking about competitive or vulnerable Democratic seats in Rhode Island and New Hampshire. And so if Democrats can close that enthusiasm gap and keep it as narrow as possible, we've already seen some movement in the generic ballot, then yes, I think they can cut their losses to perhaps as few as 15 seats.
Mm-hmm. Dave, thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me.
We'll be right back with this week's panel, but first, Haley Bickelhaupt takes a look at some of the races we'll be watching as Election Day approaches in this week's Map It Out.
There are many congressional races to watch in the upcoming elections, including several that could have impacts on Capitol Hill Committee's key to farm policy. This map shows ag lawmakers in the House seeking re-election in 2022. This year, many farm groups will be watching the efforts of a handful of Democrats seeking to hold onto elected office. This includes Angie Craig, a Democrat from Minnesota. She is unopposed in her primary, but faces a rematch with Republican Tyler Kistner to represent the state's 2nd district. Then there's Abigail Spanberger, running in Virginia's 7th district. Spanberger is the chair for the House Ag's Conservation and Forestry Subcommittee. She's likely to face a tight race with Republican Yesley Vega in November. Election forecasters also expect House Ag members Johanna Hayes of Connecticut and Kim Schreier of Washington to run tight races. On the Senate side, all eyes will be on Missouri's August primary. Former Governor Eric Greitens is in a tight Republican race to replace retiring Senator Roy Blunt, who is a longtime member of the Agriculture Appropriations Subcommittee. Greitens' opponent in the GOP primary includes Attorney General Eric Schmidt and House Ag Republican Vicky Hartzler, who is backed by the Missouri Farm Bureau. For more information on key primary elections, visit Noah Wicks and Philip Brasher's story at AgriPulse.com. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Haley Bicklehopped.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're discussing the upcoming midterm elections and some of the things that we're watching, especially when it comes to some of those rural races. Excited to bring in this week's panel for that discussion. Joined this week by Randy Russell of the Russell Group and Ann McMillan with Invariant. And thank you to both of you for joining us. Randy, I want to go to you first because the polling currently shows that the Republicans are looking for big pickups in the House and you know, potentially retaking the majority in the Senate, but we've seen some fluctuations with polling in recent elections. Wondering how much stock are you putting in the current projections of big Republican pickups in the House and the potential for a Republican pickup of the Senate?
First, Spencer, thanks for having me and good to be with my good friend Ann McMillan. You know, look, I don't put stock in any one particular poll. But I do look at the trend lines and look at the average of a lot of these different polls. If you look at the recent Monmouth poll that came out, the president's approval rating was about 36%. In the latest Harvard-Harris poll, his approval rating was 38%. If you look at the right track, wrong track, that's running anywhere from right track 10% to 20%. These are numbers for the president that are going to really drag on congressional Democrats running in November. And I think if you look historically, I think it's something like only twice in the last 87 years has the party in control of the White House picked up seats in the first midterm election. The first was in 1934. Under FDR, and the second was in 2002 under George Bush after 9/11. All other times, a party in control of the White House in the first midterm elections has lost on average 28 seats. So I think with the low approval ratings for the president and with these historical trends, I'm looking for Republicans to pick up the House. And I think very frankly, if the election were held today, would have a very good chance of picking up the Senate as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and looking at specifically the House, some of the races that election forecasters are saying as toss-ups, you know, potentially trouble seats for the Democratic Party, are areas where they had success in 2018. Some of those more moderate, perhaps suburban, maybe even a little bit of rural districts. What do you think the party needs to do to appeal to voters in those areas and to protect, if they're assuming they're trying to protect those members of Congress?
We're always trying to protect these members of Congress, Spencer, don't worry. I think it's sort of the tactics that we've always know work, right? You have to show up and you have to talk about what people care about. And sometimes what those voters who are maybe switched back and forth between parties or show up at different elections, they care about maybe slightly different things than the national party does. And so really understanding how to talk about, the infrastructure improvements or, we have a lot of these members who are defending tough seats on the Ag Committee and understanding how their expertise will lend itself to a really productive farm bill moving forward. So, I agree with Randy. This isn't like, not my ideal election characteristics for the Democrats. But I don't think, you know, we can't write this the ending just yet, where it's only July 7th, and there's some time left to try to turn this around. And, you know, we did some great work on, you know, the redistricting wasn't a wash that everybody was sort of expecting it to be. And I think Democrats picked up a few good new seats. And, you know, it's just going to take a lot of real dedicated strategic work between now and November.
Well, and Ann, over the last month, we have seen gas prices come down a little bit. They're still very high in the grand scheme of things, but they are trending a little bit lower. We're seeing some level of softening inflation. We saw the Supreme Court issue a number of opinions that, you know, I would think might serve as a bit of a motivating factor for some Democratic organizers. Do you think those kinds of factors are enough to turn any kind of tide, perhaps soften the blow for the Democratic Party?
I think they can definitely turn some of these really close races, these toss-up races. I think, you know, again, I'm if the election was held, you know, in the last 3 weeks or even today, I would be much more concerned. But we do have some runway ahead of us to move the needle forward. You know, the hard thing is inflation and gas prices are very difficult to fix overnight. And, you know, I think this administration is really trying to do what they can, but they don't have a lot of tools at their disposal. And the Congress has done, you know, quickly a lot of work, but also some of this is sort of beyond, you know, their control or certainly beyond your control to do something quickly. So let's see how long of a runway we have. And if these numbers can keep coming down and people can really focus, you know, I think the inflation piece is absolutely critical to this election. And if people are feeling they're continuing being squeezed at the grocery store in particular, you know, I think it can be rough. And so I'm looking forward to Democrats really keeping their eye on the ball on this and moving into the fall.
We'll be right back to discuss the farm policy impact of the midterm elections right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. No matter who wins the upcoming midterm elections, the 2023 Farm Bill still will require some action. When we spoke to our panel, we asked them what the impact of the midterms will be on that legislation.
Well, Spencer, it's going to have a significant impact because we're talking about who is going to control the pen, so to speak, when it comes to writing the farm bill. And if these current polls hold, and we'll have to see, as Ann said, we still have another 4 months between now and November. We'll see what happens. But if indeed what I am talking about happens and G.T. Thompson becomes the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee and potentially John Bozeman becomes chairman of the Senate Ag Committee. And let's talk about some of the challenges that regardless who's control, what's going to happen. I mean, first of all, let's look at farm bill costs. If you look at the 2018 farm bill, the 10-year cost of that farm bill is looking somewhere in the neighborhood of $860 billion. 76% of that cost is in the nutrition programs, primarily SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. If you look at the 2023 Farm Bill, which would be the 2018 Farm Bill extended for the next 10 years, they're estimating the cost. This is the Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan budget score for all legislation on the Hill. They're saying the cost of the 2023 Farm Bill extended would be $1.3 trillion. And the nutrition piece of that cost would be 85%. So basically, you've seen a significant ramp up in the cost of the Farm Bill driven by the increase in nutrition program costs. This Farm Bill is really a misnomer that we even call it a Farm Bill. When you have $1 trillion or the $1.3 trillion farm bill being spent on nutrition, you can see that the pie is getting bigger and the slice going to nutrition is getting much bigger. And that is going to farm programs and crop insurance and trade programs and research is becoming a smaller and smaller piece of the farm bill. If we have no new money, Spencer, trying to write a farm bill where nutrition's 85 cents at every dollar spent on a farm bill. It's going to be a real challenge to meet the pent-up demand there is to look at things like reference prices in the commodity title, to look at some improvements and changes to crop insurance, to look at trying to invest in climate smart ag practices, to try to increase trade and export program functions, and to look at things like other areas that are important, such as research, which has tended to be woefully underfunded. So a lot of this is going to come down to what is done about nutrition and whether we can get some new money into the baseline to fund some of these high priority initiatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Ann, we hear Randy talk so much there about nutrition, and that's obviously such a big part of the farm bill, of the USDA budget, et cetera. You know, we hear all the time that farm policy is less partisan and more regional based on northern and southern agriculture, Midwest issues, western issues, et cetera. But as Democrats continue to struggle to hold on to some of these rural seats, I mean, we saw Colin Peterson, the chairman of the Ag Committee, go down by a pretty significant margin in a rural district in this last election cycle. Do Democrats continue to kind of play in the farm policy pond outside of nutrition issues, do you think? Is that an issue that they will still generate and show interest, do you think?
Of course. I mean, I don't see, I sort of like respectfully disagree. I just don't see it as such a binary decision on the farm bill between nutrition provisions and farm provisions, especially since people need to eat the food that we make. You know, I think there's tons of Democrats who are really leading on these issues. I think, you know, just off the top of my head, like Angie Craig and Cindy Axney and Jim Costa. I mean, they're really these issues and have been long for years and years and years involved in farm policy. So I don't think anyone's abandoning it. I just do think that the party by and large tends to just represent more areas that are covered in the nutrition title. But I have found, you know, I've been through several farm bills, not as many as Randy, but, you know, generally I have found House and Senate Democratic leadership to be very deferential on the farm programs. They sort of stay out of like the nitty gritty over there and do kind of exercise some influence over the nutrition title. But that doesn't, you know, but I've found that there's always general agreement on how to move forward on the farm programs, you know, except when we start, you know, talking and about, you know, dramatically changing the subsidies or what have you. But I think that this will be a, you know, an interesting move forward. And I do agree. I think it'll be really interesting on who's in charge. But I think what is sort of notable is that no matter what the election outcome, we'll still have the same four people. Just depends on what chair they'll be occupying. But we've had, you know, four people who have been listening to growers and advocates across the country talk about the farm bill for the last couple months. And, you know, I think if there's a change in the House, we'll probably restart that process. But, you know, I think we're going to have some continuity, which will be important.
Randy, Ann, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse newsmakers. But first, Hannah Pegel checks in with this week's featured farmhand.
Kara Scudder is the head of North American Government and Industry Affairs for Corteva. He's also a founding member of the Black Professionals in Food and Agriculture. Since it was first founded in October of 2020, Gutter and other BPFA founding members have worked to expand its reach to more individuals. In a recent Meet the Farmhand interview, we sit down with Gutter to learn more about the lessons learned while building the organization and the direction the agriculture industry needs to take to make agriculture more diverse and inclusive. Take a look.
Everyone's going to come at these types of issues from a different angle. They've got a multitude of different opinions. We respect all of those opinions. We create the safe space for those opinions. But what we've learned is there is no one size fits all when it comes to responding to these issues and these challenges. And we've got to stay committed that this is not just a short term or a one-stop proposition. This is a long-term commitment and a long-term challenge that we're going to have to stick to it and be committed to.
Gutter also shares stories of his time working at USDA, including the friendly competition he had with Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack and their favorite NFL teams, along with the lessons learned working as the department's first liaison to military veterans. Head to AgriPulse.com to watch his full Meet the Farmhand interview. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at agripulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. I'll be starting the week in Sacramento with other AgriPulse colleagues for our annual Food and Ag Issues Summit. In Washington, the American Soybean Association and National Corn Growers Association will have members in town for their annual fly-ins. Congress is also set to reconvene after its Independence Day hiatus. As always, keep an eye on AgriPulse.com for the latest farm policy news in Washington and across the country. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.